Fish on Fridays, and sandwiches and pizza every day until 1 a.m.
It's 12:37. Let's take a look now at our weather. High pressure will provide the Midwest with dry weather over the next couple of days. Late this weekend, as the high shifts further eastward, a southerly flow on the backside will begin to transport warmer and more humid air northward from the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, a slow-moving storm system will approach from the southern plains, spreading rain across the region Sunday and Sunday night. High temperatures today will range from the mid-30s in northern Indiana to the upper 50s across Missouri and western Kentucky. Low temperatures overnight will range from around 20 degrees in northern Wisconsin to the mid-30s in southern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny, the high 45, the wind from the north at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 25. The wind will be out of the southeast from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny and breezy. Look for a high of 56. The wind from the south at 15 to 20 with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, not as cool with a low in the upper 30s and the wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday, partly sunny with a chance of afternoon showers. Expect a high in the upper 30s. The wind from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Sunday night, showers are likely and there's a chance of thunderstorms. We'll see a low in the upper 40s. Monday, partly sunny with a chance of showers. Look for a high in the mid-60s. Monday night and Tuesday, partly cloudy and warmer, with the low Monday night around 50 and the high Tuesday in the low 70s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-30s to the low 50s. Sunshine was reported across both states. At Rockford and O'Hare, 36 degrees. At Bloomington, 38. Mattoon checked in with 43 degrees. It was 53 at Carbondale. At South Bend, 34. In Terre Haute, 44. In Indianapolis, 42. 43 degrees at Lafayette. And Willard Airport reported 42 degrees at the top of the hour. The dew point, 18. The relative humidity, 37%. The wind out of the northwest at 16. The barometric pressure, 30.52 and steady. And at 12:40, 41 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. University of Illinois President Michael Hogan says he's determined to fix his strained relationship with faculty members following calls for his resignation and a meeting with trustees. Hogan sent an email to the U of I community yesterday promising to do better after mounting friction over his proposed enrollment management plan. Hogan Chief of Staff Lisa Troyer stepped down right before an investigation concluded. She likely wrote anonymous emails attempting to sway members of the Faculty Senate's conference on the issue. Emails obtained by the News Gazette and other news outlets show Hogan's effort to push through his plan, including what critics have called bullying of Urbana campus chancellor Phyllis Wise. Hogan told Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers he's redoubling efforts to better communicate with the university community.
Well, as you know, we faced substantial challenges when I first got here. I was fixated on addressing those challenges, which were very threatening to the institution, financial leadership challenges and all the rest. And I believe if anything went wrong, I spent probably more time, was more fixated on those challenges and didn't spend as much time and carefully visit with different constituencies explaining the nature of those challenges and how we were and the board was trying to address them. But what I want to do now is do more of what I should have been doing all along, and then to set a new tone and a new pattern for this kind of constant communications so that we don't misunderstand each other.
Have you scheduled any of the regular meetings that you've talked about on the three campuses?
Yes, we have. I don't have a complete list in front of me, but I've already met with our colleagues in Springfield. That includes the chancellor, the vice chancellor, the deans there. I met with a student leadership group, a very good group of about a dozen students. I met with members of the Springfield Faculty Senate. I'm scheduling similar meetings on this campus, especially Urbana, where we have a meeting with the faculty scheduled for March 30th.
Do you feel that, the admissions scandal and its fallout had any impact on levels of trust in the relationship between faculty and the administration at the U of I?
That's a good question. I don't feel, since I wasn't here when the admissions scandal occurred, but I really don't feel that I can speak directly to it. But it's clear that there was a breakdown in the leadership at the university, including the board leadership, and that it probably compounded the financial problems that we were dealing with, got preoccupied with other things. Then you end up in worse financial shape, and you end up with faculty that aren't getting paid when they should get paid, and staff the same. You end up with furlough days nobody likes to take. And so when the leadership breaks down at the top and the governance system breaks down at the top, all things that are necessary to pay attention to can, I'm not saying they were, but they can get slighted or ignored, and that can cause, and rightly so, additional frustration with the faculty and between the faculty and the leadership.
Some of the faculty members have complained that their input has been ignored or manipulated. If that's the case, how will you change the process of developing an enrollment management plan to meet the principles of this idea of shared governance?
I didn't receive the task force report from the faculty until December 27th. After that, there was a bowl game and two holidays and a Board of Trustees meeting, so in between that time when I received it and the time when I was beginning to prepare to respond to it, there was, of course, an eruption of opposition to enrollment management, to the enrollment management plan. But since then, I've had two meetings with the Senate's conference. I brought Chairman Kennedy with me. We've really addressed their concerns. We had not only the benefit of their task force report, but we have spent a lot of time with them trying to elaborate each point they made in that task force report. And then we've systematically tried to address their issues and their concerns. And this has been an ongoing process. I had the same process with the chancellors. A lot of give and take. We ultimately reached an accommodation I think the chancellors and I could live with. And then we went from there now into the Senate's conference, and we're going through exactly the same process. And I hope the same result, that we'll find an accommodation that we can each live with. That's my expectation.
Some people have accused you of bullying Urbana Chancellor Phyllis Wise over the enrollment policy. How would you characterize your relationship with her?
Actually, I think I have a good relationship with her, and I'd be surprised if she felt bullied. She's a very strong person, and we have free and frank exchanges, as you would expect, between colleagues doing common business, and I've never heard her use the word bully. And so while I may have sent off an edgy email here or there that I deeply regret, I think generally we work well together. And also, it's worth reminding ourselves that she's been on the job 5 months. I've been on the job going on 2 years. I'm still relatively new. She's still very new. And, in fact, we're still learning how to work with each other. But I have I hired her and recommended her appointment to the board. I have a vested stake in her success. If she doesn't succeed, I don't succeed. That's for sure, and vice versa. So I think we're working out our relationship just fine, and I think it'll be a wonderful and collegial relationship over the long term.
You told me in January that you would like to eventually find someone to perform the tasks of chief of staff in replace of Lisa Troyer. When do you hope to fill that role?
I think it's going to be a while. It requires at least an internal search and exploration, and Right now, I feel that I can parcel out a lot of that work to other people in the office, the vice presidents. They're all working too hard already, but I'd rather handle it that way and give the selection of a new chief of staff the time and attention that it deserves when I have that kind of time.
And then finally, do you feel that you have the resources and environment you need to effectively execute the charge that you've been given, given what's been going on?
Yes, I think I do. And I plan to do that. I just hope to do it with a little more success.
University of Illinois President Michael Hogan, he spoke with Sean Powers. Illinois Public Media News is always online at will.illinois.edu. Follow our Twitter handle at willpublicmedia. It's 12:48 Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. In North Carolina, Walmart has unveiled a new ad campaign in the Charlotte area. The commercials are unusual because they target a small regional grocery chain, Harris Teeter, by name. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world. Harris Teeter is 207th. Walmart says it's the first time it's ever done this, but it plans similar campaigns in other markets. Scott Graff of member station WFAE has more.
One of the commercials goes like this.
Here at Walmart with Amy, a Harris Teeter shopper, we have her last grocery receipt. We're going to go buy the same stuff and see the difference. Let's shop. Strawberries with you.
The shopper ends up buying all the same things and saving about 10% over North Carolina-based Harris Teeter. The commercial highlights price differences at the world's largest retailer compared to those at the 207th largest. David Livingston is a Wisconsin-based grocery analyst.
What's someone going to do to fight back? When your prices are 15, 20% below your competitor, what can your competitor do at that point, especially in a weaker economy?
So what is a small chain like Harris Teeter to do? The company declined to be interviewed, but Jared Hansen, a professor at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, who used to work in marketing for Walmart, says chains that have higher prices than Walmart shouldn't concentrate on cost.
Keep focusing on the quality they're offering, the customer service, the cleanliness of its stores, the relationships it has within the community, and that's what's going to keep them going, because there will always be people who will shop Walmart because of the cost, who will shop Harris Teeter because of the quality.
Walmart says it plans more commercials like those in Charlotte and other markets soon. The company hasn't said where or when those ads will begin. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
And here is the writer's almanac for Friday. It's the 9th of March, 2012. It's the birthday of a writer who called his own books the chewing gum of American literature. Crime novelist Mickey Spillane, born Frank Morrison Spillane, Brooklyn, 1918, son of an Irish bartender. He was selling ties in a department store when he met a co-worker whose brother produced comic books, and Spillane went to work for him, writing comics, and he invented a private eye named Mike Hammer. He turned out more than 30 novels, most of them featuring Mike Hammer, including Kiss Me Deadly, The Girl Hunters, Body Lovers, and The Killing Man. His books sold more than 225 million copies. It's the birthday of Vida Sackville West, born near Sevenoaks, England, 1892. Daughter of an English baron, she grew up in the ancestral mansion in Kent, a building with 365 rooms. She was beautiful, more than 6 feet tall, had dark eyes, fell in love with several women, some of them schoolmates. When she was 21, she married a diplomat, Harold Nicholson, even while she was in a passionate affair with another woman. She said of Nicholson, "Our relationship was so fresh, so intellectual, so unphysical, that I never thought of him in that aspect at all. Some men seem to be born to be lovers, others to be husbands. He was of the latter category." an unconventional marriage, but they remained devoted to each other for the rest of their lives, wrote to each other daily when they were apart, raised a son together. When Vida Sackville-West was 30, she met Virginia Woolf at a dinner party, fell in love with her, they became friends, and then lovers. She was the inspiration for the main character in Woolf's novel Orlando. Sackville-West wrote more than 15 novels herself, but today she's better known for her writing on gardening. She wrote a weekly gardening column for The Observer for 15 years, and that's what is still read today. Here's a poem for today by Philip Booth entitled Saying It. Saying it, trying to say it, not to answer to logic, but leaving our very lives open to how we have to hear ourselves say what we mean. Not merely to know, all told, our far neighbors, or hear beside us now the stranger.